Everybody. Hi, everybody. It's Radio Basics. Yeah. Welcome. Tonight is Monday, the 28th of September, and I'm here in the studio. This is Alex. I'm here with Steve, and he's getting some music together. Steve, how are you tonight?
Well, now that my mic is up, I'm pretty good.
Sorry about
I'm
that.
Pretty good. I'm a little under the weather today, but I'm all right still. We got a good show lined up for y'all. Mm-hmm. But before that, I want to play a little track. This track is by Stickman. Oh. The song is called Traffic Jam.
Thank
and the songs
you.
Are going out to all you who feel like you're stuck, if not in traffic, in life, in your job, things aren't going so well. You know, we're feeling you. This is why we do this show. This is why we do what we do. Because we're all about defending working class people in their day-to-day struggles. So before we get the show started tonight, let's kick it off with some Stickman, Traffic Jam. Steve and Alex, we'll be back. Radio Basics.
We miss where we going. Situations sometimes get frustrating, but if we won't make it, we got to have patience.
Life is a traffic jam. Life is a traffic jam. Sometimes life is a traffic jam. 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 Sometimes life is a traffic jam. Life is a traffic jam. So let's jam. Let's jam. Beep, beep. Let's
Let's jam. Let's jam. Traffic jam.
Tell the people what you're here for.
Maybe bring everything out closer to the people.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
An oppressed person will fight back.
2-4
baby. Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
That's right, a proper introduction for a proper show, Radio Basics. We back, and my phone is ringing. I don't know who that is, but I hope that's not one of the guests we're having on today, but they just got muted. Steve and Alex, we're back. This is Radio Basics. We're here for another week. We got some federal news items, some international news items, and later on in the show, we are going to have on two interviewees. One speaking on Iran and one speaking on Venezuela. And the topic we're going to be exploring today on Radio Basics is how the third world or the dependent world, the semi-colonial world, however you like to refer to it. I prefer semi-colonial. I think it's the most precise term given the economic and political relations in the world. How this part of the world is aligning against imperialism at this time in history. What I mean by that is how formerly dependent countries are more and more asserting their independence at this time in history. And we're going to be looking at how Venezuela and Iran, two countries in particular, are playing into that in the different ways in which they are and the contradictions entailed therein. And what else we got, Alex?
I'm going to be talking about the Toronto Declaration. Well, actually, what happened this year at this year's Toronto International Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And the opposition that came from some of the filmmakers involved and also just people who would usually go and participate in the Toronto International Film Festival, the opposition they had to the spotlighting of the city of Tel Aviv during the festival. So I'll talk more about that later.
That's in cultural news. Moving on to federal news now. Mark Emery, the outspoken marijuana activist, is being extradited to the United States. Today, the outspoken marijuana activist and cannabis entrepreneur of British Columbia, Mark Emery, turned himself into the British Columbia Supreme Court to be extradited to the United States, where he may serve as much as 5 years in a U.S. jail for his role in promoting and selling cannabis products over the internet to many customers, among whom were American customers. If anybody was listening to the news today, I'm sure you heard this story over and over and over again. What Canadians may have also heard were other Canadians claiming that, you know, how this extradition signals extradition of a Canadian citizen, right, caring about his business activities in Canada to the United States, how this apparently marks the end or suggests the end of Canada's sovereignty, as if American tanks will be rolling over the Canadian border tomorrow. And I think this raises some interesting questions. I mean, certainly the extradition of Canadian citizens to the United States for things that they're doing in Canada is absolutely outrageous. And certainly Mark Emery is not the first person to be extradited to the United States. So this is something that Canadians should be upset about. But I think the invoking of the end of Canada's sovereignty in this whole discussion is a bit of a joke, in the sense that when you look at Canada's relationship not only to the United States but many countries in the world, what you see is Canada not only asserting its sovereignty but actually throwing into question the sovereignty of other nations like Afghanistan, like Haiti. When you look at the fair trade agreement, free trade agreements. I even hate the term fair trade or the whole concept, but the free trade agreements that Canada is imposing negotiating with undemocratic, dictatorial governments in Latin America, like Peru, like Colombia, like Panama. What we see is that Canada's sovereignty is not going anywhere, and Canada and the United States work very closely to deny many other countries in the world of their sovereignty. But nonetheless, on this topic of the extradition of Canadian citizens, it's definitely something we should be worrying about. Moving on to more federal news. Prime Minister Stephen Harper offers his thoughts today on Canada's economic action plan, so-called. Today, as Parliament was resuming and the Liberal Party was tabling a motion to bring down the Conservative government this week, Prime Minister Stephen Harper made his strategically timed announcement that, and I quote, 90% of the stimulus package of his government's economic action plan has is already underway. And it's not an accident that Harper... Harper at the same time underscored that the beginnings of economic recovery are already visible, apparently, in this due to this economic stimulus of his. And this so-called recovery at a time when, you know, over the last year, 500,000 full-time jobs were wiped out of the Canadian economy since October 2008, with only about 100,000 part-time jobs partially offsetting those losses. You know, while the country sits at in stagnation with nearly 9% unemployment and roughly zero growth right now, you know, the big Canadian banks and the Bank of Canada are predicting an upturn. And while they're doing so, such forecasts, I think, should be viewed with an air of suspicion, since it's these institutions that actually have their own interests in seeing, you know, in keeping what they call consumer confidence up. But Canadians understand what they can and can't afford in this economy, despite the term consumer confidence. And the data for the summer of 2009 is now showing that bankruptcy rates among Canadians have skyrocketed. They're up 35%, higher from last year at the same time. And numbers can probably only be expected to continue climbing as more and more Canadians who lost their jobs soon lose their eligibility for EI. That is, those who were even eligible for EI in the first place, employment insurance. So in a stagnant economy with a high rate of unemployment, Canadians should really be aware of, especially working class Canadians should be aware of all this forecast mongering of stock traders and big businesses who like to pretend that their economic interests are the interests of the majority of Canadians, of working class people. For example, in the third quarter of 2009, Royal Bank of Canada saw their profits jump by 24%, right? This while most other Canadians are suffering from lack of job security, stagnant or slashed wages, and many lost jobs. It should also be recalled that the economic action plan that Harper was celebrating today contained within it the massive bank bailout, which Basics Free Community newsletter covered very earlier in the year. And the details of which were almost completely blacked out by the mainstream media. In late 2008 and early 2009, the Canadian government quietly revealed a massive, massive bank bailout program running into the hundreds of billions of dollars, whereby the Canadian government was preparing to buy back from the Canadian banks assets, particularly the mortgages of Canadians. And at a time of economic crisis, which the big banks and the government has directed and displaced onto the backs of working class people, the massive sell-off of these assets can be seen as a way for the banks to safeguard their assets by passing off the cost of all the bankruptcies and mortgage defaults of Canadians onto the public. So what I mean by that is that the Canadian government, through the Canadian Housing and Mortgage Corporation, bought up billions of dollars of these assets from the banks at precisely the time when these assets were about to fail. So basically taking the bad assets of the banks and displacing them onto the public or public debt, which we will pay for in the form of slashed social services and whatnot in the coming years. So this is something we really need to look beyond and interrogate and investigate in this much celebrated economic action plan of the Canadian government. And even if we do go to elections, I really don't personally have faith in the other parties, because they've done very little to expose the ways in which this economic crisis has very much hurt the working class, and it's benefited the largest interests of capitalists, the monopoly companies, the banks especially. In international news, last week world leaders assembled for a General Assembly of the United Nations, and tensions among world leaders escalated over Iran, with Israel beating the war drum and calling on its imperialist allies to confront Iran. Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu waved Hitler's final solution, trying to claim that the existence of Israel was equally challenged by Iran's energy program. Netanyahu, however, while condemning the UN for allowing Iran's president the democratic right to make a speech at the United Nations, failed to mention how its own arsenal of nuclear weapons of mass destruction, Israel does indeed have many, many nuclear weapons, and how it continues to threaten the entire region of the Middle East and also occupy historical Palestine. These hypocrisies and contradictions were not exposed in Netanyahu's speech. Meanwhile, the Libyan leader at the United Nations, Muammar Gaddafi, called on the United Nations Security Council, which he calls the Terrorist Council, showing how undemocratic it is as a structure in the international order, and it's under the dictates of the five veto members of the United Nations, which is United States, Russia, Britain, France, and I'm missing one, I think. Why can't I remember? Yeah.
I don't know who it is either. Sorry.
Russia, Britain, United States, France, and yeah, I'm missing one. Anyways, and China, of course. Days later, the leaders of the 20 largest capitalist economies met in Pittsburgh, and Alex is laughing at me, to coordinate their policies around the global economic crisis. U.S. President Obama echoed the Israeli Prime Minister's messages of isolating and confronting Iran. And in today's news, Western media and governments condemned Iran for testing missile weapons, though the hypocrisy of such denunciations made by the most bellicose and violent governments in today's world makes the calls a little bit ironic, especially as the bloody and violent occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan continue. These countries have not a shred of moral legitimacy to trying to be a call out other nations and states' military programs, and not to bolster the legitimacy of the regime in Iran, which is a dictatorship, a theocratic dictatorship at that. But every nation has a right to self-defense in the face of these violent countries. And just going back to the G20 summit that happened last week in Pittsburgh for a moment, I had a piece that I wanted to play that I think is telling of the current order and the way it's working. This is a clip from the G20 summit of protesters outside the summit and how the police responded. One second.
Subject to other police action.
Munitions, which could cause risk of injury to those who remain. By order of the City of Pittsburgh Chief Police, I hereby declare this to be an unlawful assembly. I order all those assembled to immediately disperse.
That was the sound of Pittsburgh Police and the United States National Guard warning students of the University of Pittsburgh and other youth on the streets of Pittsburgh at the time of the G20 summit that less than lethal weapons were being prepared to be used against them and that they should clear the streets.
Of their illegal protest.
Of their illegal protests. Yes. Which
standing.
Protests are only legal when they actually do nothing whatsoever. Assembling and protesting when it actually matters is illegal. So, moving on in the show, we are going to be coming back with our interviews. We're going to be talking about Iran and Venezuela in the modern world, in a state of imperialism and crisis, and how nations of the third world are fighting back against imperialism and reorganizing the international order. In the meantime, I have a little song that I wanted to play. This song is from the new musical ensemble Street Sweeper Social Club, which is Boots Riley of The Coup, and the drummer from
really?
Forgetting his name. Yeah, you haven't heard this band yet?
No.
So I do have to call up the song. But maybe Allison, tell us the story of when we went to see Boots Riley live in Montreal.
Yeah, I went to The Coup in Montreal. It was great, but I was exhausted. Steve was studying in Montreal, and I went to help him move back to Toronto. So I spent the entire day packing up his apartment into his car, his old beater. And then we got to the concert, and I sat down on a stool at the bank, and I fell asleep for the entire concert. And then I met Boots Riley, and he was obviously disappointed because he saw me sleeping at the back of the concert.
concert.
You were sleeping at his concert.
Yeah.
But it was.
But I really enjoyed it. It was great. I was only half asleep. My eyes were closed. But I just, like, I couldn't get up and dance. I was exhausted. Yeah. Sorry, Steve.
No problem. So, this is Street Sweeper Social Club, 100 Little Curses. And we're offering you this song. This song is going out to all of the enemies of the people. All of the G20 leaders, all of those sitting behind closed doors of boardrooms dictating what wars are going to be waged next, what nuclear weapons are going to be launched against which countries can and can't have nuclear energy programs. Yes. This is for you. This is 100. Yes, 100 Little Curses coming out your way.
Community. This is CHRY 105.5 FM.
Radio Basics, we're back. You were listening to Tom Morello and Boots Riley in Street Sweeper Social Club. That was 100 Little Curses. Moving more on to international news and introducing our interviews today. This past weekend, leaders of African and South American nations met in Mérida on Margarita Island off the coast of Venezuela for the first African and Latin American summit, a summit intended to solidify economic and political relations that are independent of the South or Third World, depending on the terms you want to use there. Among the resolutions of the African and South American summit were creating a new Radio of the South, formalizing the Bank of the South, criticizing the makeup of the UN Security Council, and supporting the exiled, well, now back in the country, but overthrown Honduran President Manuel Zelaya, the democratically elected president. Meanwhile, the anti-imperialist Hugo Chavez president of Venezuela, along with the Libyan president, Muammar Gaddafi, called for the creation of a NATO of the South in order to counter the military threats of Europe and North America. Meanwhile, on the other side of the world, tensions were rising between Iran and Western imperialism as today as Iran launched a missile test and the imperialists were decrying Iran's show of power. I think it's more of a tragedy than it is an irony that those denouncing Iran's independent nuclear energy program have themselves massive stockpiles of nuclear weapons and also a near monopoly on the world's oil trade. Tonight we're going to be speaking with Arash Azizi, a longtime journalist in Iran, now in Canada. He's one of the founders of the Afghan-Iranian Youth Network and its newspaper. He's a writer for Nadaya Mardom. We also have Nicolas Lopez of the Toronto Latino organization Barrio Nuevo, and also one of the founders of the Barrio Nuevo's initiative, Frente Norman Bethune. And we're going to be speaking about the role that Iran and Venezuela are playing in the world today in countering imperialism. Arash, Nicolas, thank you for being with us today.
Sure.
Nicolas, are you there?
I'm here.
Thank you, brothers. So, the topic today is trying to understand the role that the countries, the leaders of Iran and Venezuela are playing in the world today in countering Western imperialism. And I fully appreciate that there's big differences between Iran and Venezuela. But what we had this weekend is leaders of the South, of Latin America and Africa in particular, coming together to particularly President Hugo Chavez and Muammar Gaddafi, claiming that it's possible to have a military alliance against imperialism. So let's talk about Iran and let's talk about Venezuela. So beginning with Venezuela, Nicolas, how is Venezuela over the last couple of years, what is the relationship of Venezuela to the West or to imperialism?
Well, Venezuela has taken a very important role of leadership, organizing first within the region, but most widely throughout the global South, and that's based on the principle of multipolarity. So in the Western Hemisphere, that principle of multipolarity comes from the Bolivarian idea that there should be a greater homeland or patria grande. And based on that, throughout the past 4 years or so, there has been a very important initiative called the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, and recently renamed Bolivarian Alliance for the Americas, and this is basically an agreement, right? It's a multilateral agreement between, and is open to different nations in Latin America and the Caribbean to join. Actually, it has about 9 members now, including some smaller islands in the Caribbean, and larger countries like Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, Cuba, Honduras, and of course Bolivia. So that's one way that Venezuela has begun to change the geopolitical map, and something that shows that it's becoming something threatening is the recent coup in Honduras, right? And after President Zelaya, who is from the Liberal Party, not necessarily a historically very progressive party, he did begin to implement some very progressive policies, and he decided to join ALBA. And that led to what was the coup of late June.
So that is to say, taking Honduras more out of the Western economic and political sphere and putting it more into the sphere of Latin America.
Honduras had historically been very controlled by imperialism, more specifically the United States.
Yes.
They had a military base from which the U.S. military coordinated all of the actions in Central America during the 1970s and 80s. And this was done through paramilitary activity, through flow of weapons, different ways because of the position of Honduras, and that has meant that the people of Honduras have been very, very subject to that control, and perhaps their forms of political and social organizing haven't been as successful or as advanced, to put it some way, as in other parts of Latin America or even neighboring places like El Salvador.
Now, so if I can just stop you for a second.
By hitting Honduras, it's basically the weakest link within the ALBA.
Yes. Now, I mean, it's fully understood that foreign policy is a reflection of domestic policy or the domestic internal class structures in a society. So moving on to Arash, I just want to say with the qualification or the preface that I understand that Iran is a very different country than Venezuela, but it has also been giving difficulties to Western imperialism. So maybe, what are your thoughts on Iran's role in the world today?
Well, the first the question that Iran has given troubles to the Western imperialism is very ambiguous. Many imperialisms has given trouble to each other.
Yeah.
Even Israeli imperialism has given trouble to U.S. imperialism, and definitely European imperialism have given troubles to U.S. imperialism. So as long as the role of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the current government of Iran, is concerned at the world scale, what we have to see is that this is the leader and the head of a reactionary, inhuman movement of political Islam or fundamentalist Islam, as it is sometimes called. And as the head of that movement, it has been always open to negotiations with imperialism. It has been all its biggest wish, its biggest reason d'etre, its biggest political aim has always been to present itself as the legitimate representative of the Iranian people and, you know, of the region, and to kind of do for United States and for imperialists what the Shah regime, for example, did, and, you know, just what Colombia does right now in Latin America. So classification of the Islamic Republic as anti-imperialist, it's very crude and, you know, doesn't reflect the realities. So Ahmadinejad, especially since coming to power, this man has been, you know, trying his best to come near to the U.S. imperialism. He is the one who has attended United Nations summit five times, by each and every time. I think he's one of the few head of states who hasn't missed a single opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the one who congratulated Obama when he was elected. He is the one who, at his time, and I don't want to go for too long to details, but at his time, I can show you that for the first time since the revolution in Iran, there was direct negotiations of U.S. government and the Islamic Republic government. So they are trying their best. Their problem that they have, and the reason that they sometimes have to clash with United States is two things. Number one is that, of course, United States doesn't accept them as the, you know, as the legitimate government of the country. The reason is not that United States has a problem with, you know, political Islam or anything. They are the founders of the political Islam movement, by the way. They are the one who invented this heinous monster in order to crush leftism, socialism, and communism in the, you know, in the so-called Islamic world. So this is number one problem, that they don't accept them because they have internal problems. Like Islamic Republic is not, you know, it doesn't have a stability because of the oppositions of the people. And the another problem is that the Islamic Republic has always identified itself and has always, you know, kind of legitimized itself as opposition to the so-called Great Satan, as the United States, and to just put it away and go hand in hand with, you know, with the Western imperialists is a big problem.
So this is more rhetoric than it is substance. This is not a country that can be qualified as anti-imperialist.
The thing that I always say, and I usually refer to a joke to explain the situation, is that, you know, the anti-imperialist rhetoric of the Islamic Republic is like the old John Wayne cowboy movies. You see, in those movies, there's usually a girl who, in the beginning of the movie, slaps, you know, John Wayne in the face, but that's, you know, kind of a thing to do in order to, you know, get with him later on in the end of the movie. And this is what Islamic Republic does by, you know, slapping Western imperialists. The only difference is that in this scenario, I don't think they will actually be able to get on with it.
So how do we explain the massive hysteria in the media right now. It's similar to the hysteria we saw like a month ago when North Korea was testing its the nuclear weapons that it admittedly has with around Iran's energy program. How do we explain the hysteria that's currently unfolding in the world?
Well, it's the so-called nuclear crisis, like every other crisis, is a pretext to is a pretext to for international power plays, power games, right? So the United States and the other Western imperialists, and even the Russian and Chinese imperialists, if you will, mm-hmm. are dealing with the Islamic Republic, and they of course use this language, of nuclear, nuclear bombs or nuclear weapons. You have this nuclear program, they use this as a tool in the negotiations. So that's all there is to it. Like the hysteria that they create is one part of the, of their attempts to delegitimize, for example, Islamic Republic, and, try to play these games with it. But they have, of course, I don't need to tell you here that they have no problem with the idea of nuclear weapons. I've never heard they having problem with India or Pakistan, who already has it.
Israel.
Israel, of course, Israel, and themselves, of course, are the biggest, they have the biggest stockpile of the nuclear weapons, and the only one who has actually used it against humanity.
So moving on now back and bringing the conversation back to Venezuela and the increasing independence of Latin America, let me ask you, Arash, what do you think about President Hugo Chavez or the diplomacy that Venezuela has taken towards the Ahmadinejad and the government, the current regime in Iran? And then I'll bring the question back to Nicolas to see what you think as well.
Yes, I have to start with saying that I see myself as a fervent supporter and admirer of the Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution. And to the degree that Hugo Chavez has taken any attempt to further this revolution, and he certainly has since the last 10 years ago that the revolution started, I am with him. And I support, and I understand the role that President Chavez has in the eyes of the masses in Venezuela because of the very progressive role that he has played in the revolution. However, the position that he has taken toward the Islamic Republic is utmostly outrageous. It's the most unacceptable thing that he has done in his entire time. He has, and I'm not the only one saying this, by the way. There are a lot of Venezuelan people who are saying this. For example, Corriente Marxista Revolucionar, which is a pro-Chavez party, pro-Chavez current in the PSUV, United Socialist Party of Venezuela, has opposed and has protested Mr. Chavez's alliance with Ahmadinejad and with the Islamic Republic. What I can tell you is a very simple calculation. Mr. Chavez is supporting counter-revolution in Iran. Islamic Republic and its all of its organs, and especially Ahmadinejad, are part of a vicious counter-revolution. They have always been a counter-revolution in a sense that they were the one who crushed the revolution of 1979. But this is now exacerbated because there is a current revolution, a new revolution going on in Iran, and these are, of course, its enemies.
Absolutely.
But, my message to anybody in the Venezuelan government, and I have given this message to Venezuelan consulate in Montreal and in Toronto, is that the only real friend of the Venezuelan revolution are the Iranian people and their revolution. And let me just wrap up by saying that I totally support and understand the need of trade alliances of Venezuela with Iran, with Libya, with any other country in the world. Like trade alliances, I'm all for it, and there is no problem in that. However, the problem is, calling Ahmadinejad your brother and calling Islamic Republic an anti-imperialist or a progressive regime. And, history will not absolve Mr. Chavez by going to Iran in this crucial time. History will not absolve it this time. It is the time that all the leaders of leftist Latin American countries, even if only for a political genuine, stop supporting Islamic Republic and support the movement, because this government of Islamic Republic is not going to be there for a very long time.
Now, Nicolas, how do you find the foreign policy of the Venezuelan government to be a reflection of what's happening internally in terms of the revolution, but also in terms of counter-revolutionary elements within Venezuelan society who do not support Chavez, but even some of those who maybe do? How do you find the foreign policy to be a reflection of that domestic situation?
Well, I think that it's reflective of the domestic situation and the fact that it's pragmatic. I'm in agreement to what was just said. I do not think that the diplomacy needs to go to the extent of brotherhood or that kind of kinship with Ahmadinejad, who certainly has many things to be criticized and many... There's many shady parts of it, of his role as the head of government, and I do understand that the Venezuelan government and Chavez, as a strategist that he is, as a military man, to put it in a nutshell, my enemy's enemy is my friend, right? So it's a question of power once again. I think it's an alliance, obviously, with a country that, or a state that is being, whose nuclear energy program is being challenged by many of the imperialist countries, and Venezuela, and not just Venezuela, but also Brazil and other countries in Latin America have not sided with those imperialist challenges. So. Being understanding of that, Chavez has slowly gotten close to the Iranian government. As I see it from my point of view, with a pragmatic purpose to build that multipolarity. Iran and Venezuela have had a historic relationship due to the fact that they were both founders of OPEP and the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC. And
Nicolas, I'm just wondering, should we also explore the fact that internal to Venezuelan society, excluding those who are completely at the disposal of the imperialists, right? Internal to Venezuelan society, you have different class interests, right? And you may have those class interests which are benefit more from their relationships with, say, the national bourgeoisie, the national capitalist class in Iran, and the national capitalist class in Venezuela, versus the people of Venezuela, who maybe are not benefiting as much from that relationship, or could benefit more from seeing a truly revolutionary Iran in the world?
Well, I think in the economic sense, like leaving aside geopolitics, leaving aside the political significance of that sort of alliances and the impact it has internally with the revolutionary movement within Iran and also internally in Venezuela and the relationship between those two movements, right, social movements, just looking at it from an economic angle, I believe that it does benefit, actually, working class, because some of those agreements mean the transfer of technology to Venezuela, and that entails making tractors, right, for agriculture, or making vehicles like cars. There's other sorts of agreements that have to do with education of different sorts. So there is a benefit a tangible benefit, right? Now, there is also many cases, I won't go in depth on it, of Iranian nationalist bourgeoisie investing money in Venezuela, and it's people that don't have any political interest. They're just in there for business, and I would like to add also that there's a degree of corruption. Mm-hmm. There's been cases in which Iranian companies, one of them produces milk, and dairy products. They were questioned, and not just them, but also.
Sorry, we're running out of time. So, just a few more words. Arash, do you have any response to that?
Yeah, what I want to quickly say is that I totally appreciate, and you know, the Iranian, like the Iran trade relations between Iran and Venezuela has benefited Venezuela. However, the most important thing, as for the internal relations of the Venezuela, is for the revolution to go forward, which will only happen if Hugo Chavez, the President Chavez, go on to extropriate the bourgeoisie, extropriate the means of production, and then, and you know, abolish the capitalist state and establish a workers' state. And a workers' state, of course, will have a question of the diplomacy and how to deal with Islamic Republic and all the other governments of the world. And then, then we can be happy to serve as advisors of such a workers' state in Venezuela.
So to conclude, maybe 30 seconds to a minute for each of you. In this time of intense capitalist crisis in the world, of a crisis of imperialism indeed, moving from a period where U.S. was hegemonic and coordinated with the other imperialists to a period when there's a lot of contradictions developing in the world, what are the possibilities not only for a greater independence of third world states, and that potentially for the most part is going to be with the national bourgeoisies at the head of those movements, or potentially revolutionary movements? What are the possibilities in the world today for not just greater independence in the third world, but even revolutionary movements? Let's start with you, Arash.
The question, Steve, is that, you know, what kind of independence, of course, you know, we are talking about. And the independence, ultimately the independence of a capitalist third world nations from the first world nation is not only impossible, it's also undesirable. I mean, there is a world market, there is globalization, and you cannot stop it. The world, you know, the world capitalist crisis wouldn't stop it at all. I mean, it would go on to some economic nationalist tendencies, which, if anything, would only hurt third world countries more than anybody else. But, you know, as on the basis of capitalism, this is what capitalism has to offer for the humanity and in 21st century. You know, the plight, the hunger, and all of it that it comes with. However, I am extremely confident that revolutionary movements, that the very, very big and great one you're seeing in Iran, will happen, and in Venezuela, will happen, you know, all over the world, in different countries. The capitalism will be cut in its weakest chains in these countries. And then, you know, and the probably what will happen on a world scale is for revolutions and workers' state to establish in a few third world, you know, countries, and then, you know, then this will be like a spark in Western countries themselves for revolutionary movements to happen, and for us to go towards socialism, which I'm confident is the only way that humanity has to go if it's not to succumb to barbarism.
And Nicolas, any final words? 30 seconds.
Definitely. I think that's one of the challenges. There is a positive steps in the case of Venezuela taking a lead as a government, as a national state, of promoting the integration and the greater unity among the countries, and that's the political will that is very important. But then again, behind them, there's international capital, and that international capital has no nation of origin. They're interested in investing, they're interested in developing and accumulating more capital, and they do it through transnational corporations, whether they're from the United States, Europe, or... And then again, there's social movements, and that is the effort that we need to, as actors in the global north, we need to get involved in developing relations with those movements, with those organizations in the south, and strengthening and positioning the networks of movements and the proper articulation between social movements, positioning that at the level of states and governments and capitals, so that our interests are the interests of revolutionary movements are also taken into account as priorities.
Thank you very much, Nicolas Lopez of Barrio Nuevo, and Arash Azizi, one of the founders of the Afghan Iranian Youth Network, their paper, he's a writer for Nadia Mardom, longtime journalist in Iran and also a supporter of Fight Back magazine. Thank you, brothers, for being on the line with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to commercial. Radio Basics, we'll be back.
This is Kieran Aluwalia. You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM, York University Radio, the rhythm of the people.
Hi, everybody. We're back. It's Radio Basics. As usual, Steve and his guests have taken up all of our time, and
sorry,
I don't get a chance to speak or say anything. So,
Alex had some pieces.
In the last 3 minutes, this is what I'm going to do. First, I'm going to shout out our good friend Gaddafi, as you made reference to him meeting up with some other players in Venezuela.
That guy's just an enigma.
He's great, though.
I don't understand it. I respect the fact that he's just so insulting to imperialism.
Exactly. He embodies the general sense of disdain that we feel towards the UN General Assembly, like the United Nations in general, because they're useless. They don't do anything, and he's pretty much sticking it to them. Yeah. He didn't actually develop like a specific train of thought or, you know, any political line, but he made reference to a lot of very important issues, especially African and Arab unity in the face of all of this imperialism and all of these, you know, all the crap that's going on our continents. And then, you know, he's just, I love him for what he did. They gave him 15 minutes, he took 100, and he said what he had to say, and he took his space. So, thank you for that.
But you had some cultural news too, no?
Yes, I do. The Toronto International Film Festival, some filmmakers waged
a boycott.
You know, it was a boycott. Yeah,
they
put together the Toronto Declaration, which its slogan was "No Celebration of Occupation," because the Toronto International Film Festival tried to present this sort of festival that was called City to City, to like represent the diversity of cities across the world, and they wanted to start with the city of Tel Aviv. They tried to present the celebration of the city as a completely apolitical event, but given that it is Israel's seat of military and economic power, and especially given that we started the year with like that massive siege on Gaza, which murdered thousands of people, it can't really be seen as anything other than political. And the director of TIFF, whose name is Cameron Bailey, he tried to deny the connection between the Israeli occupation and the film festival, like this city-to-city section of the film festival, but he was baited out by the Canadian Jewish News, who reported on the 16th of this month that the mayor of Tel Aviv confirmed the Israeli government's participation and support of TIFF city-to-city spotlight. So, you know, nice try. But it didn't work.
But you know what? They built a pretty large contingent of artists and supporters in Toronto and around the world.
Yeah,
like Toronto was the center of world attention for a minute.
Yeah, and it was the exact opposite of what they wanted to have happen with this campaign that they waged. Was exactly what happened. So we had
that's good
filmmakers from the States.
Is political.
Exactly, and that's exactly what they were trying to...
All art is political.
Trying to show with...
But in a positive light. What's going on this week?
What's going on this week? Well, what actually started a couple of days ago is the Toronto Palestine Film Festival, which, its goal is basically to... So, what is that?
Someone's
light?
Calling. Yeah.
It's
but continue.
So on the about page of the Toronto Palestine Film Festival, which you can find at www.tpff.ca, it says that TPFF was conceived to introduce Toronto audiences to the richness and diversity of Palestine and Palestinians. So our festival strives to inspire new perspectives and celebrate film as a thought-provoking art form. The festival showcases the extraordinary narrative of a dispossessed people living in exile or under occupation, and the films examine a wide array of topics from a unique and underrepresented Palestinian perspective, highlighting the dynamism of Palestinian culture. So that's been going on since the 26th of September, and it will go until the 2nd of October. Tomorrow night, so Tuesday night, since we've already missed some of the stuff that's been going on this evening, started at 7 o'clock, but Tuesday, September 29th, at Jackman Hall at the AGO, starting at 7 o'clock, there will be four films screening. You can still buy tickets online for those. Regular admission is $10. If you're a student, a senior, or an unwaged person, tickets are $7. And yeah, the film festival will continue until Friday, so check it out if you can. Once again, the website is tpff.ca. There's actually one more thing that I wanted to do before we go.
Do it up.
Basics is not just about trade unions and workers' unions. It's also about unions between people. And I would like to congratulate...
Who said we're just about trade unions?
I'm saying we're not. Exactly. Oh, okay. We're about unions between people, such as our host Steve tonight and our lovely friend and comrade Nadine.
who...
We're going here, eh?
Yeah, we are. Who are getting married, everybody, and they have occupied our lives with 5 days of engagement preparations for their wedding, which isn't even going to happen
another week. It's a South Asian, Portuguese, and Arab wedding. So
yeah, so it's pretty
don't
involved.
Don't be hating on like the 25 events that we got.
Of course not. The food's always great, so you know that balances it out. But I just wanted to give a shout out on the radio to Stephen and Dean. Congratulations. We all love you and support you, and we're very happy that you're getting married, and that you'll be having lovely little babies someday soon.
I love you too.
I don't change diapers though.
What's that?
I don't change diapers.
If you're going to be an auntie, you got to change diapers.
I don't want to do nothing. That's it.
But you know, Alex, my comrade Alex here, is also the new head of the Arts and Culture Committee.
Oh God.
Of Basics Free Community Newsletter. And I believe they're looking for interested artists who want to get involved in community organizing and Basics in particular.
If you'd like to get together with other artists in the city who are trying to develop their own political consciousness and also bring... create spaces in the city where we can talk about politics and art and put them together and, you know, really recognize art for the power that it has in terms of social movements and social education, then please get in contact with us. We don't have an email yet.
And so forward it for now to basics.canada @gmail.com.
And you can put the Arts and Culture Organizing Group or my name, Alex, on Radio Basics in the title or the subject heading. And yeah, we'll get in touch with you. And if you're not interested, but you know someone who might be, then get them to hit us up, please.
And more generally speaking, we encourage people to get involved in Basics Free Community Newsletter. And also CHRY. We are community media organizations, community media apparatuses. Yeah. This is what we do. We work for the people, and our work is made possible by the people.
Yeah.
We're struggling alongside the people who are listening to the show, you know, dealing with this economic crisis, dealing with the fact that a lot of us come from countries where we've been displaced by war, by imperialism, and we ain't just going to forget that when we come up in here and get exploited by the workplace up in Toronto.
Speaking of economic crisis, CHRY will be hosting a Sound Investment, which is their fundraising drive. Starts on October the 14th and goes to the 24th. We're letting everybody know.
Which is the opposite of an economic crisis. We're going to have an economic boom up in here because the community who makes possible the work of CHRY is going to support us another year to keep us going, keep us you know, on the airwaves, alive and strong another year. A Sound Investment that's coming up in October.
Put your pennies together. Get some rolls at the dollar store, you know.
Put your
start
dollars
a drive.
Together. Put
your start a drive on. At your school. Yo, pennies count too, you know.
And those are rolled and then cashed and then brought into
the station. Yeah. Or you could also just write out checks for hundreds of dollars.
But I think we're looking for about $100,000 of pledges. Mm-hmm. And we need that money to keep community radio going. As if you listen to our airwaves and you notice that we don't have commercials playing every 5 minutes. And when we do, it's not... you know, corporate ads that are being rammed down your...
ads for community events.
Exactly. You know, we support the community.
Events are on the way.
So, to conclude for the day, I got a track. It's by a Canadian band out of Steeltown, Arkells. And the track is Ballad of Hugo Chavez. And so revolutionary salute to comrade Hugo Chavez down in Venezuela for doing what he does. But more importantly, far more importantly, right... revolutionary salutes to all the people of Venezuela who make Chavez possible, and who, when Chavez was kidnapped in 2002 by a CIA-backed coup, it was the people that fought to bring him back. So salute to those people, those brothers and sisters that make the revolution in Venezuela possible. And thank you, our listeners, for being with us here tonight. We have the Blue Show coming up next with Vince, and this is the Arkells, Ballad of Hugo Chavez. Radio
Good night,
Basics.
Everybody.
We out.